This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. In January of 1900, a time when racial terrorism across the South increased sharply, George Henry White of North Carolina was the lone Black member in the House of Representatives. And to address the violent lynching of Black people at the hands of mobs, George White introduced a bill to make lynching a federal crime, one that would be punishable by death. White's bill failed to make it out of committee, and the path ahead for a federal anti-lynching bill would ultimately stretch on for more than a century, blocked from passing on more than 200 occasions. On June 4th, 2020, Senator Rand Paul obstructed a piece of anti-lynching legislation sponsored by then-Senator Kamala Harris, along with Senators Cory Booker and Tim Scott. According to Paul, the bill's definition of lynching was too expansive.
To suggest that lynching would only be a lynching if someone's heart was pulled out and produced and displayed to someone else is ridiculous. And on this day, the day of George Floyd's funeral, on this day, a day that should be a day of national mourning.
But last week, after some amending to get Senator Paul on board, the Senate finally passed federal anti-lynching legislation. Named the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act, it was passed with unanimous consent.
I ask unanimous consent that the bill be considered, read a third time, and passed, and that the motion to reconsider be considered made and laid upon the table with no intervening action or debate.
Without objection.
Of course, it's a momentous historic occasion that was passed, but I also couldn't help to think about how long it's taken.
Historian Paula Giddings, Professor Emerita of Africana Studies at Smith College and author of Ida, A Sword Among Lions, a biography of Ida B. Wells, took the long view on the passage of this bill.
It's been 130 years since Ida B. Wells began the first anti-lynching campaign, and 112 years since, she's a co-founder of the NAACP. And in 1910, at its first annual conference, she gives a speech asking the NAACP to support federal anti-lynching legislation. And she gives a speech called Lynching Our National Crime, saying that lynching now is a national issue, not just a Southern issue, it's a national issue, and so needs federal legislation.
I turned to Professor Giddings to learn more about the role that anti-lynching activist and journalist Ida B. Wells had played in calling attention to lynching more than a century ago. Professor Giddings told me that an essential part of Wells's work was to correct some major misconceptions about why so many Black people were being lynched by white mobs.
It is true, and she admits it herself in her autobiography, that with these charges of Black men raping women and of white women and of rising criminality reported in the news, she and others were wondering what was, and it sort of happened sort of suddenly, the reporting, and they're wondering, well, maybe what is going on? Are Blacks really doing this? You know, I think we've had even some more contemporary parallels with this when we hear about Black criminality. She said, well, are they really doing it? Or what is going on? And she wasn't sure. But then as she does her investigative reporting and she sees what's really going on, she really understands this new idea of Blacks being criminalized in the press, of fictive notions around Black criminality in the press. And she begins to bring that out. And as a result of the investigative reporting, she also begins to understand, and as you mentioned, the lynching of her friend, of a friend in Memphis who's really guilty of having a successful grocery store that competes with a white man's grocery store, that really what lynching really is, and what racial violence in general really is terrorism to keep Blacks down.
What did Ida Wells hope that federal anti-lynching legislation would do?
A couple of things. One is she wrote a essay called Enfranchisement Stops Lynching. and she wanted the legislation to, one, there was such complicity of officials, including, you know, sheriffs and state officials and others lynching. And as a result, it had become legitimatized in many ways because authorities were involved in it. And as she would say, the South and the North's best men, the so-called best citizens, were often involved in lynching. And so she wanted anti-legislation also to criminalize officials who were involved in lynching was one thing. The other thing is she understood that anti-lynching legislation also, you had the means to actually show what was really going on through legislation, if you could prosecute legally what was happening to blacks. Because remember, lynching is extra legal. Mobs could just form, and a mob could be just three or more people, could just form and kill someone with impunity. So legislation would begin to bar and minimize that.
So here we are, all this time later. Certainly there continues to be racial violence, but this is not Ida B. Wells's America, in some ways at least, happily, and largely because of the work that she and others did. I'm wondering what the value of the anti-lynching legislation is for us in this moment.
One of the things certainly it does is shine a light on the status and what is happening to African Americans in the society even now. I mean, of course, this recent lynching legislation is, you know, in the wake of Charlottesville, of George Floyd, of Breonna Taylor, of Ahmaud Arbery. And I started thinking about all the other times that lynching really becomes in the forefront of the American consciousness. It's always been in the wake of some terrible tragedy. In 1892, when Wells starts her campaign, it was in the way lynching was reaching a new height in the late 19th century. In 1900, when George White of North Carolina really proposes the first anti-lynching legislation, it was in the wake of the Wilmington Massacre. In Wilmington, North Carolina, where hundreds of people, of black people, were killed. And the whole black, including middle-class community, was just leveled and devastated. In 1910, when Ida Wells proposes first federal anti-lynching legislation, this is in the wake of the founding of the NAACP, which the catalyst is a terrible Springfield riot of 1908, another time when the black community is actually leveled and hundreds are killed and thousands are forced to flee. And later, of course, in 1921, when anti-lynching legislation comes closest to being realized, because the House did actually pass that legislation, but it got bogged down with Southerners in the Senate. But in 1921, it was in the shadow of the Red Summer of 1919, where white supremacist terrorism really emerged in three dozen cities across the country within that year, with major riots in places like Chicago and Washington, D.C. So in some ways, this legislation is also a way, I think, to measure really still the difficulty of African Americans under white supremacist terrorism.
So often, the story of lynching in our public memory is a story of white male mobs that descend upon black male victims because of, you know, in exactly the way that Ida Wells devastated in her actual research, right? But the narrative would be a sexual crime against a white woman. But left unspoken in all of this is, is where Black women were. And I'm just wondering also about the ways that our public memory tends to erase both Black women activists like Ida Wells and others who were so central to bringing about this moment more than 100 years later, and Black women who were victims, Black women and girls, who were violently murdered by lynch mobs.
Ida Wells also wrote about Black women who were lynched, and probably a very conservative estimate, Melissa, is that some 200 women at least were lynched between 1880 and 1930. Ida Wells wrote about them as well, but she also deconstructed the idea of who was really being raped. I mean, she linked lynching with rape, but not with the rape of white women, but the rape of Black women. And also talked about that in her discourse. You know, the very first time she wrote about lynching, which was before 1892, it was about the lynching of a Black woman who was, her name was Eliza Woods, we should call her name, in 1886, who was accused of poisoning her mistress, and who was taken from the jail, stripped. Ida Wells describes this, stripped naked, hung in a courthouse yard, and her body was riddled with bullets, and the body was just left there. This was her first really consciousness around the brutality of lynching. So Black women were lynched too, but also Black women saw it as a Black woman's issue because women, particularly in the Victorian period of then, really embody racist sexuality. So if men are considered bestial and hypersexual and monstrous, it's because their women were that. So when Ida is defending Black men, she's also defending Black women, and that's very important. Black women had a tremendous stake in anti-lynching. Even contemporarily, there were also mothers of men who were lynched and female relatives of men who were lynched. But this was also, if you understood lynching and could unpack lynching, you would unpack all those horrible stereotypes around not just Black men, but around Black women as well. Which is why Black women, when Ida Wells starts that campaign in 1892, Black women support her en masse. And that's why the National Association of Colored Women are even supporting anti-lynching legislation even before the NAACP is founded, and later before the NAACP really gets on really supports anti-lynching in a full-throated way. So it's very important to understand that Black women are very much involved and very much responsible for the rise of consciousness around lynching and violence that goes beyond individual victims, but also what it says about them, about the community, and about Black people.
Paula Giddings, Professor Emerita of Africana Studies at Smith College and author of Ida, A Sword Among Lions. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.